Hello, everybody. A very warm welcome to the Göbekli Tepe to Stonehenge podcast. I'm Michael Bott.
Yes, and I'm Rupert Suskin. So, welcome all.
We are the prehistory guys, but of course you've worked that out already, I'm sure. The Göbekli Tepe to Stonehenge podcast, it's a bit of a sidebar to the huge major project that we have in progress at the moment, which is a film called Göbekli Tepe to Stonehenge. I'll probably say that more about that in a little while. But in the process of making that film and in doing the research, we're lifting the corner of the carpet in all sorts of aspects to do with the Neolithic period that we perhaps wouldn't have done otherwise. So we have this strand on the channel to delve a little deeper. So it is with the topic of this discussion. Now, we're going to be talking about obsidian. We had absolutely no idea how crucial this black stuff was to the spread of farming from Anatolia and the Fertile Crescent into Europe and its importance to prehistoric archaeology in general until we were researching for this film. That's pretty much the size of it, isn't it, Rupert?
Absolutely. It's actually quite staggering how widespread the passion for this extraordinary material was, and quite how widespread it was. The fact that it was traded over such vast distances, and that's essentially what we're going to be talking about today, and how the extent of that trade had such an impact on everything that happened subsequently. Thousands of years of influence. Yeah.
Trade is the word, but we'll come to that crux of the matter a bit later on. But obsidian, everybody's heard of obsidian, but we've got to talk about what exactly obsidian actually is first, I guess, to make sure we're on the same page with everybody. Which one of us is best qualified to launch into that exercise?
But we don't need to be technical on it, do we? It's volcanic glass.
No.
Basically. If you love Game of Thrones, it's dragon glass. But yes, it is just a glass material formed through volcanic activity. And it is the sharpest material on the planet. It can be worked to literally a molecule of thickness on the cutting edge. So it's sharper than surgical steel, which is extraordinary.
Yeah. I think the only reason I think that it isn't used often as surgical steel, I think it's banned by the FDA in the US of A, is because relative to steel and steel, it is far more breakable. So you don't want,
absolutely,
surgery, you don't want bits breaking off.
There is also the side aspect that you can take a piece of steel and you can put it in a steaming, sterilizing oven. And with obsidian for, probably more than once, it would just break into pieces.
Oh, goodness gracious, I didn't realise that aspect of it, which is strange considering its source. It is lava, basically, lava flow, which has cooled very rapidly. That's, I think, the defining thing.
But it is extremely brittle. That's the thing, which is why it can be napped to such extraordinary sharpness. But there you go. So, yes, that's obsidian in a nutshell.
So, saying, of course, that it's dependent on volcano activity to exist in the first place, that rather limits the number of places from which it must be obtainable. As we'll go on, without listing every single one, there will be certain areas that we'll be mentioning limit the sources of the kind of obsidian that we're talking about to, some quite narrow areas. I think that's about it as far as it's anything we missed. That's so broad. We're talking about...
It's broad by necessity, though. really.
Yeah, yeah. Otherwise, we'd get bogged down a bit. Yeah. Yes, but obviously, the areas we're going to be talking about, and you know, go back to David to Stonehenge. We're starting off in Turkey and prehistoric Anatolia, and moving west. So it's the sources that were available to these people, and not just in the Neolithic though, but earlier into the Mesolithic, and available to the people we sort of lump under the label of hunter-gatherers. And yeah, well, there's a little term that we're beginning to challenge even more and more, and you'll find out more about why we're doing that, I think, as this podcast progresses for various reasons. So should we go on to talk about obsidian in prehistory? There's one more general point I think to make that is it's a sort of overarching thing about obsidian. It's become very, very important to archaeology in general. Do you want to outline why that is, Rupert? Before we get into the details of who, what, and why.
It depends. Are you talking about the petrology?
Well, I'm talking about the ability for the petrology to be done on obsidian because it has characteristic fingerprint petrological aspects to it, which means that it's sourced. Once you find a piece of obsidian, you can tell, if you've got all the right equipment and the right skills, you can tell pretty much precisely which source it came from.
You can, and it's remarkable, really, when you see the extent of the petrology, where sometimes there are different sources that look quite similar overall petrologically, but the lab technicians, and this is mind-bogglingly brilliant work, but they can then go into other trace elements, and I can't remember what they are off the top of my head, but they can then pick different other trace elements and match those up to specific sites, which is why they can tell that in some cases, you know, there were just hundreds of miles from the source deposits. It's remarkable lab work that they do.
And it wasn't until the 1960s, and I think Colin Renfrew and one other was at the forefront of this in a paper that was published in 1968, that for the first time the study of obsidian from known archaeological sites in Anatolia was able to prove that far from these villages isolated and dotted all over the place, far from them being isolated, that they must have been trading with each other because of the instance of obsidian from sources hundreds of miles away.
Yeah.
Before the study of obsidian, you couldn't tell, you couldn't say with certainty that one community, you know, was talking to another, one village was talking to another, yeah, the other side of the hill necessarily. But not only with obsidian can you say, well, they're obviously talking to them just over the other side of the hill, but they're also communicating with people hundreds of miles away.
Yes, it's an astonishing statistic that out of all the prehistoric villages that were excavated in the Near East, that of the tools that they found in these villages, 80% of the tools were obsidian, with 20% just flint. And that statistic stood for that stuck for 150, 200 miles from the source deposits. And it was only after about 200 miles that the percentages of obsidian tools began to drop off until you get to, a good example is Jericho, which there were still some obsidian tools there, but mostly flints. But the thing is that that's 500 miles from the nearest obsidian deposits. So, you know, even 500 miles away, they're still accessing it. It's quite remarkable.
Yeah, it is. And the thing is, once you've got a network, once you've got something, you know, that's not forcing, but is an engine that has people moving about, then you've got an engine that provides exchange of ideas, so that, you know, if one thing takes off in one place, then you get things taking off in places not too far away, almost at the same time. And so there's a kind of gelling effect that this black stuff and the networks that it created, not just in Anatolia, but, you know, further afield, as we'll probably touch on later. But it provides a different context for looking at, you know, how things developed and ebbed and flowed in the area of the Fertile Crescent and at that time, all to do with farming, development of farming. It's an interesting aspect
stat as well, that when you say at this time, and it's that's a good point to make, that something I found quite surprising was that if you go back 11,000 years, then obsidian was, you know, it was there, but it wasn't hugely used. It certainly wasn't in general use. And then fast forward 1,000 years, 10,000 years ago, obsidian is everywhere. Everybody's using it. So in that 1,000-year period, there was clearly this, you know, this realization that this material was just better than everything else. And then this booming network where people, I mean, what was the mechanism? What was the trading mechanism? Or the, you know, the bartering or whatever, you know, that that you could travel from your local source of obsidian and take it hundreds of miles away, or, you know,
Well, that's a question we've been asking forever and a day.
It is.
Since I was pointing a camera at you at the top of Piker Stickle in the,
Yes, the Langdale X Factory, yes.
Langdale X Factory, yes. That's another story. We get a bit ahead of ourselves. But you just said, you know, a period of time, 1,000 years from 11,000 years ago, i.e. 9,000 BC to 8,000 BC. That's what you meant, isn't it? So, yeah, that's, a little very general portrait of things in Anatolia. But the thing is, not only was obsidian known of being used, being traded in that period in the Neolithic, pre-pottery Neolithic, all that stuff, but it is also known that obsidian was being traded and used and being quarried, shall we say, by Mesolithic people, i.e. people we would refer to as hunter-gatherers, much earlier than that, going back 13,000 years, I think, certainly in the Aegean area. We have proof of that, although you say, I think, in Northern Europe and there are there is evidence of obsidian traveling huge distances even before that.
Certainly, there's Siberian obsidian found in Siberia. There are various sources for that, but they have found, for example, there are two key sites for obsidian in Japan. A lot of the Siberian obsidian came from Japan, going back to this sort of period in time. So the thing is that the vast amount of archaeological research done that we find in the West, anyway, it's very West skewed. We don't know that much about the Far Eastern sources. There's a certain amount we know about the Far Eastern deposits of obsidian, but it's not something that we know about in the archaeological record, really.
Yeah, But it was more the date I was interested in for the Siberian.
Going back and
placing it within the Mesolithic.
16,000 years is the oldest that I know of off the top of my head, but it's old enough.
But what I'm saying is, by placing that date of obsidian in Siberia at that date, 16,000 BC. Yes? Correct me if I'm wrong.
I can't correct you if I'm wrong. I'd have to go back to the paper to be 100% certain.
Nevertheless, a very long time ago. The thing is, the obsidian was coming from a long way away.
Mm.
Okay, so these are people that we would otherwise call hunter-gatherers, and yet they must be engaged in trade networks and talking to people a long way from the other side of the hill. So there's a certain sophistication going on already deep into the Mesolithic. You know, this sort of thing is changing the character with how we view hunter-gatherers, but bringing it straight back to the Aegean and the importance to us of obsidian in the spread of farming. The earliest record I think there is of obsidian in the Aegean dates from 11,000 BC, and it comes from a cave in Greece. Well, I forget the name of the peninsula. The Argosid Peninsula, I think it's that. It's only about 2.5 hours drive from Athens down there, but it's the other side of the peninsula from the Adriatic, if you see what I mean. Obsidian from an island called Milos, which you'll hear mentioned many, many times from now on in
yes,
this
you
podcast,
will.
was found in the Franschthy Cave, which is actually something a bit more than a cave. It's a vast sort of shelter hollowed out by the waves and the sea or whatever, by erosion. It's a lot more than just a hole in the side of a cliff. Put it that way, is enough under this covering for a community to live. But the point is, they had Milesian obsidian from the island of Milos there 11,000 years ago. Okay, now getting obsidian from Milos means undertaking a sea journey of, I think, about 75 kilometers. Something like that, or is it miles even? I think there are reasonable routes which involve island hopping, but nevertheless, here again, we're talking about people we call hunter-gatherers, and yet, how in the first place did they know? Because Milos was not inhabited at all until the mid to late Neolithic. So they're going to an uninhabited island, and taking the trouble to get this stuff and bring it back. And of course, you know, and to the rest of mainland Greece at that time.
Yes, and there are aspects to this which are particularly important that it's very easy for them to go unnoticed, really. But if you can go back that far and find that obsidian from very specific sources was being preferred, then you've already gone through a period of history where people were establishing that this was, you know, that this location provided a better quality than this location. And so already 11,000 years ago, they're prepared to take maritime routes. They've got seafaring routes in order to supply or to get the better quality obsidian. That in itself is quite remarkable.
Absolutely. But to be fair, I think that there are only two other sources. All the sources in the Aegean and the Mediterranean are island sources. There are no mainland sources in that area.
Although the Anatolian sources...
Oh, that, well, yes, I was going to say, until you get onto the mainland Turkey, this is a different story entirely.
So people could have been, as just a common thing, almost on a daily basis, people could have been exchanging the land-based sources... the mainland-based sources, if you like. It was still the fact that when people discovered this extraordinary quality, that it became the preferred and travelled crazy distances over time, didn't it?
Yes, but there are only two other sources in the Aegean available to those people that were inhabiting the Franchthey cave, and they are known to be inferior sources. You know, now they are, anyway. Yeah, the point is, though, that in Mesolithic times, they already had trade networks going and operating over, quite considerable distances at sea.
Yes.
How that came about, we do not know. Maybe have something to do with the tuna that they were fishing, you know, which requires going, you can't stick a fishing rod in the sea and have it from the mainland and from the beach and hope to catch tuna. You have to be intentional with a decent boat going out to sea to catch tuna, and they were. Whether that's got something to do with the discovery of obsidian, we don't know. From our point of view, and here's where it gets interesting, is that by the time that, and we're talking, after Göbekli Tepe, we're talking about after Çatalhöyük even, which incidentally as a sidebar is another study as far as obsidian is concerned, Çatalhöyük, because although it was getting its obsidian from central Turkish sites and maybe some from up Albania, that sort of area. But we're talking about after as farming proper had got going, that the trade networks from the hunter-gatherer people in the Adriatic were already going and gyratory and people were going places. So when farming got going in southern Turkey and south west Turkey on the coast there, you begin to see Milesian obsidian from Milos appearing in the coastal farming settlements and villages in that area in Turkey. They're not getting their obsidian so much from their own sources in Turkey. They were getting it from Milos, so they must have been engaging with the people in the Adriatic that were already, sailing round and getting the stuff. So they're engaging with the hunter gatherer people. The farmers are engaging with hunter gatherers. So trite way of putting it, because we've got to adjust that hunter-gatherer thing. But the point is that when the farmers are engaging with these people that are already sailing the seas, it is reckoned, and we pay lip service to it, that farming crossed the Aegean for the first time and ended up in Greece. And spread from into the areas of Thessaly and further up into the Balkans and up into what's now Bulgaria, Romania, Serbia, etc. From that time, and we think it's the circulation of obsidian in the Adriatic that first caused that breach to be made of farming people to cross the sea and get into mainland Europe. Anything to add there, Rupert?
To add to that or to move on? I don't think we need to add to that. You put that very succinctly, really. I think it's an interesting thing, people trading. You mentioning the maritime stuff. So people in the Aegean arriving in places, you know, by boat, that it's something that we know from later prehistory, that actually travel by boat was in many ways a lot faster and safer than travel by land. And so to have people arriving by boat at all these coastal, you know, maybe little fishing settlements and what have you, that it's no real surprise that, you know, that people from, you know, bringing obsidian from Milos would have arrived at the western coast of Turkey more readily than people traveling by land from some of the eastern obsidian deposits in Turkey. You know, it would have been quite a lot quicker to come by boat. So I think that's got a lot to do with it as well.
Little factoid here, that the first Neolithic farming settlement known in the Aegean is on Crete, and actually directly below the Palace of Knossos, deep, deep down. When they dug down, they first found the first Neolithic set, dating to 7,000 BC. And interestingly, the cave, Franchthy Cave, which I mentioned earlier, which is on the coast there, that is a hugely important archaeological site. The implications of what have been found there stretch way beyond what we've been talking about here, because it has been occupied for such a long time that it's got a real stratification of many thousands of years of use, which is why you were able to get the 11,000-year-old obsidian there in the first place. But on mainland Greece, Franchthy Cave also contains the first evidence of farmers being there. It's got the first wheats and emmers and domestic cereals in that cave as well. So, you know, Franchthy Cave, we could do a whole program on Franchthy Cave, I think, and probably will when we get back from the next bit of filming for Göbekli Tepe to Stonehenge. Yes. So I think it's probably a moment, just take a moment, and I'll say some words about that.
I just want to take a moment to tell you what this channel is about and how you can help. We do live shows, hot topic specials, video podcasts, films, all aimed at figuring out what people were up to in the millennia before writing came along. We do our best to be honest and fact-based, and although we like to keep it real and our reporting is based on current archaeology and archaeological thinking, that doesn't mean we don't challenge the status quo from time to time. And talking of keeping it real, here's an astonishing fact. Did you know that 83% of the people that watch this channel are not subscribed to it? So, if you're enjoying the content, here's the first thing you can do to help us do what we do. Hit the like and subscribe button. Right now, the goal of hitting 100,000 subscribers is getting close, and getting there will be really massive for us. Thanks for helping out. Second, for just $5 a month, you can become a Patreon member. You'll get an exclusive Patreon-only podcast every Monday, members-only conference call on Zoom every month, ad-free video content, and all sorts of behind-the-scenes updates. You also get to be part of a lovely community of people as well. The other thing is, we've started filming a massive project called Göbekli Tepe to Stonehenge. Thanks to donations so far, we've already been filming in Turkey at Göbekli Tepe and Çatalhöyük and other sites, kicking off a story to be made into an epic documentary film telling how the early farmers spread from Mesopotamia to eventually become the megalith builders of northwestern Europe. There's lots more to be done, though. You can help us take you on an extraordinary journey and make this film a reality by donating now at our Buy Me a Coffee campaign site. Click on the links down below for the full story. With your help, we can continue to bring you the best content, the best info, the best guest expert archaeologists, the best news updates on all things prehistoric. Thank you.
Yes, we will most definitely be talking a lot more about that. It's interesting, something that we can never really avoid is that so much of our knowledge is based on you know, what has been found, what has been excavated, and we still don't know what is lost. So, you know, this is a picture of the past that is, you know, put together from the tiny broken pieces of jigsaw puzzle that we find. So it would be interesting. Do you know what? It's an interesting point, or a good point, to say that one of the other really solid pieces of evidence that we have, you know, if you think from an archaeological point of view, that we only have what has been found. So anytime somebody says, this is the oldest blah, well, no, it's the oldest that has been found. It's the oldest that we know of. It's not quite the same thing. But when it comes to genetics, then we can tell from analysis of ancient DNA that the farming in the West, we do know that the earliest farmers did have basically Greece and Aegean ancestry. Now, the jury is very much out on where they came from, but it can be said with absolute certainty that the farmers in Western Europe originated in the Aegean. Over what period of time, we can't say with 100% certainty, but that's where they kicked off. So essentially, all the farming that we know about did start in the Aegean and move west.
Mm-hmm. Now, I can't say, you know, what the drivers took farming sort of northwest into Europe and up the Danube. But we can reiterate the point about obsidian being a major cause and enabler of the spread of farming, is it seems that the same sort of thing was going on in the Mediterranean. Mm. Because there was a Mediterranean strand of the Neolithic going on. So, you know, farming sort of split into two routes, if you like, one up the Danube and into northern Europe, and one along the north coast of the Mediterranean. And it seems that the same sort of thing was going on in the Mediterranean, because in the Mediterranean, I think there are four islands that are sources of obsidian. In a sort of little circle round the Tyrrhenian Sea, which is a sea just off the west coast of Italy, between Italy and Sardinia there. Sardinia is one of the sources of obsidian there, and I've forgotten the name of the other three islands. But you've got evidence in the Mesolithic of the same sort of thing going on. There was trade going on. Obsidian was turning up in all sorts of places that they shouldn't, in that area along there. Mm. So when farming spread that way, again, it seems to have been taking advantage of trade and fishing and whatever routes that had already been pre-established by so-called hunter-gatherers in the Mesolithic, that the whole spread of the impressed ware, the cardial ware people, as they went further west, was accelerated, shall we say, by this system that already pre-existed.
I have to say, so in my own
the question
head,
mark in my mind. Sorry, go on. Rupert. I was just going to finish the question mark in my mind is what sort of stuff were hunter gatherers really up to? What sort of society did they really have? And what sort of interaction was really going on between the first farmers and the hunter gatherers? You know, was it one of resistance or of cooperation, trade, interaction, mutual benefit? Who knows? All question marks. I'm sorry I interrupted you.
No, it's a curious thing. We know that there were these two strands of the movement of farming coming west, and as you mentioned, there's the site coming down through the Mediterranean, the line, if you like, coming down through the Mediterranean, yeah. and the other going up through along the Danube and spreading waste across the land, spreading its way across the land. Now, I personally like to imagine it being that the southern route, these are the seafarers. These are the people who, you know, they've spread these ideas, travelling, you know, port to port to port to port. Whereas the people who took the Danube route, these are people who are more comfortable travelling across land. They know that you know, they know the places that they're going to stop and the people they're going to visit along the way. These two different sort of cultural sources, and we can see that's something that's continued through history. You know, you know, whether you've got say the Silk Road later on, where people travelled for thousands of miles, you know, trading specific things along that route, as opposed to, you know, you look at all the maritime trade of whether it's metals. You know, we know that. You know, coming much later. So, for example, the ores that were taken from Cornwall into Europe and things, and vice versa. So it's a very different mentality, whether you, whether you're a seafaring folk or a terrestrial folk. So I think that that's where the main differences lie. But what would they have been trading? They wouldn't have just been travelling with obsidian. What else would they have been taking with them along the way?
Well, that we've got to come to our imaginations and what people do trade in, because the other items, the perishables, well, they're perishable. The clue's in the name. We'll never know about them. You know, whether it be textiles, cloth, foodstuffs, wood, you know, artifacts made of perishable materials, we'll never know about that, which is why this black stuff is so precious as an indicator of what people were doing in this very early period in our history and in the Neolithic. And as we'll see, is when we'll probably do more, will certainly be stuff in the film, and we'll certainly do more about this later. The same thing pertains to when it comes to polished stone axes, those that have particularly come from the Alps, you know, the jadeite stuff. The similar kind of networks must have sprung up then when polished stone axes became a thing and things of very, very high value. I think we've run our course as far as obsidian, as far as we know about obsidian for the time being.
Yeah, there's one other thing I'd like to toss into the mix, though.
Yeah.
And that's that coming much later, we do know, for example, that particularly when metals started being brought into use, that obsidian as a tool started to lose its the preference, really, because it was easier to make metal tools and use those. But people were still using obsidian for precious items. So they would make ornaments even. You know, there are plenty of obsidian ornaments that were still being used.
Sure, yeah.
And even to the extent that they have found, archaeologists have found, not a whole one, but a large piece of a table that was made out of obsidian. Now, Lord knows the size of that lump of volcanic glass that they started off with to make a table. But the thing that I wanted to point out was that unless you have a context, or in fact, even if you do have a context archaeologically, you could dig up an obsidian artifact at a site, and you can date the rest of the site from whether it's charcoal, whatever, you can date the rest of the site to whatever point in history. But the point is that obsidian, that object, might actually have been traded and passed down hand to hand for, we have absolutely no idea how long. There could have been really quite attractive obsidian artifacts being exchanged for a very, very long time. And the archaeological record wouldn't necessarily fill in the blanks of, you know, those bits of information. That's all I wanted to say.
I think you make
you make a good point, because I think it's something we need to underline before we leave it, and that is, if we haven't done before, and that is the value and the utility of obsidian. I mean, aside from the artifacts that, you know, later came into use when metal became available. And I think the tell... I'm sorry, this is a bit of a pun.
That's shameful. Shameful.
I think the tell for it is in the obvious importance that and the high value that it was obviously given, particularly at Çatalhöyük. Because there, one of the mysteries of Çatalhöyük is why so much obsidian was hoarded.
Mm.
The great caches of the stuff, unused, you know, as if they're put aside for a rainy day, you know, or as if it was a kind of bank. You've got an obsidian bank almost for use. You could never. So you weren't in danger of running out of obsidian, because of course obsidian probably has a very short usage life.
Too brittle.
It's easily breakable.
Yeah.
So useful because of how sharp it is in you know, microblades, knives, saws, whatever, arrowheads, of course.
Mm.
You name it. But I just thought I'd underline, you know, what you said just now, you know, and the value in its utility is quite a made it quite a precious thing in those times, and by extension a very powerful driver of what people were up to. I think I will have called this, or sort of labeled the thumbnail for this podcast on YouTube, the Obsidian Revolution.
That's fair.
I think it's fair enough to stand by that and give it its proper level of importance in the study of the early days of the spread of farming and in prehistoric archaeology general. And with those words, I think it is time now to say bye-bye, and hope you enjoyed our little discussion of the black stuff there, Rupert.
Indeed, indeed. So, yes, well, we'll see you next time, folks.
Yeah, look forward to that. Don't know what it'll be about, but keep your eyes open. And thanks for listening. Thanks for watching. Bye-bye for now.
Cheerio. I've been waiting to cough for ages.